So my name is Lou Tassinari. I'm the Executive Associate Dean of the College of Architecture, and it is my profound privilege to be able to introduce Bill McKibben. Just briefly, Bill McKibben is an author and environmentalist. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, is regarded as the first book for a general audience about climate change and has appeared in 24 languages. He is the founder of 350.org, the first planet-wide grassroots climate change movement, the Schumann Distinguished Scholar in Environmental Studies at Middlebury College, and a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And he was the 2013 winner of the Gandhi Prize and the Thomas Merton Prize, and holds honorary degrees from 18 colleges and universities. Foreign Policy named him to their inaugural list of the world's 100 most important global thinkers, and the Boston Globe said he was probably America's most important environmentalist. But why? What is there about what Bill has really done that's led to all these accolades? And I think I have a relatively simple way to explain that. I think what he's done for the last 25 years is essentially unpack the message in this poster. And this poster is a slightly tweaked version of the poster that appeared in 1970. It was one of the first posters for the first Earth Day. And I think it's because the message there is depressing, yet hopeful. And it's accessible, yet profound. And from my reading of Bill's work, those descriptors are what characterize his work. Another way to maybe think about it is to quote from the late Jacob Bronowski, and to say that what Bill's done with his work is close the distance between the push-button order and the human act. That's a little bit opaque, but let me just say it again. Is to close the distance between the push-button order and the human act. So rather than dwell on that, I'd like to introduce Bill McKibben and say again that we're profoundly grateful that he's here, and he has a friend here, and we all know he also has a friend in the planet. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's a pleasure to be here, and I gotta say, it is a pleasure to be in this slightly more intimate surrounding than last night. We had 2,000 young chemists in some auditorium or another, and it was great fun, and they were very attentive, and it was good, but it was not exactly a conversation. It was a little closer to a lecture. And I'm hoping this will be more in the order of a conversation, and I want to talk discursively for, I hope not the whole hour, and save some time, if that's okay, for questions and discussion and critique and everything else. And though we'll get to it in the end, I'm really not going to spend an immense amount of time talking about climate change. I'm going to sort of take it as a given for the purposes of this discussion that people are on board with the fact that we're going to have to make some serious changes in short order in order to deal with the largest problem that the world has stumbled into. And I want to talk more about what it is that the world might look like on the other side of fossil fuel. And with that, to begin to give sort of some sense of how we might get there. I don't want to talk about engineering. It's not my specialty. And anyway, it's the easy part of this process. Human beings are extremely good at building new devices and figuring out how to make them work and things. And we've done a lot of that work over the last 25 years. The engineers, like the physicists and chemists, have really done their job. You know, the cost of a solar panel has dropped by 95% over the last 20 years. Stuff that was toys a quarter century ago are now easy to use. There were days last week when the state of Texas generated a third of the power it used from windmills within the state's borders. We're getting good at this stuff, good enough that it's possible to at least begin to imagine what the world might look like if we moved in that direction. And I think that moving in that direction would be more interesting and more profound and more powerful than merely switching out one set of devices for another, replacing coal-fired generating station with solar panels. I think that that in fact it's possible that we stand near the edge of a really interesting transformation. In certain ways, as interesting as the last great energy transformation when we learned to use hydrocarbons a few hundred years ago, which was an epic event in human history. At the beginning of the 18th century, when we first learned how to burn coal in engines in ways that we could harness easily, it was, at least for people in the Western world with access to that technology, as if we went from as if we were suddenly each awarded 50 or 100 slaves to help us do our bidding. Keynes once tried to calculate how the human standard of living had improved in the 2,000 years before the discovery of fossil fuels. And he said, after painstaking calculation, that perhaps over that period of time, the human standard of living might, over those millennia, might have doubled, but that was it, because we really didn't discover all that much new in those 2,000 years. We already knew at the beginning of it about the wheel and about the sail and about banking and about the plow and things. The great innovation was this ability to replace muscle power with something else. And that something else, because of the nature of fossil fuels, carried with it then particular implications for the way that the world worked. Sometimes people talk about the fact that that the sort of dominant feature of our lives is the capitalist system in which we're embedded, and they either celebrate that or want to change it in some profound way. And I think in certain ways, though I understand what they're saying, the markets are incredibly important, it in a certain sense misses the mark. I think it's no accident that Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, the essential book about capitalism that undergirds our system today, that he wrote it 30 years after James Watt invented the steam engine and not 30 years before. Ideology followed technological change in this case. And because fossil fuels are such magic stuff, easy to get at, though less so all the time now that we've exhausted the best supplies. I don't know if I can get it any closer there. Or maybe I can switch microphones if you want. Because fossil fuel is such magic stuff, it led to certain ways of organizing things that have been very dominant. It's available in relatively few places, and hence its control was by relatively large institutions. It was easy to transport and very rich in BTUs, so it made sense to use it in the ways we've used it, which are largely kind of centralized, big centralized power stations that we then run lines out to all the rest of us. And if you think about that, the way that we've developed much of the rest of our economy and society in the centuries since kind of mirrors those concentrations of power. Agriculture came to look much the same. With the advent of cheap fossil fuel, we were able to replace most people who worked on the farm. 150 years ago in this country, 50% of Americans were farmers. Today, that number is under 1%. We have twice as many prisoners in America as we have farmers, okay? That kind of highly centralized system is beginning, I think, to break down in lots of ways. Those concentrations and exaggerations of size and power have begun to sow the seeds of their own undoing. So we got a sense of this in the financial system in this last economic crisis in 2008, 2009. The phrase you'll remember that was the most important phrase from that crisis period, the phrase was that these banks had become too big to fail. Anything that's, and in Washington, what that meant was sort of code word for we need to bail out these banks with taxpayer money. But in fact, if you think about it in kind of systems terms, anything that's too big to fail is a priori too big and needs to be made smaller, needs to be built down to the point where its failure isn't catastrophic. The same thing is true of our agricultural system, and the same thing is definitely true of our energy system, whose failures are becoming dramatic. In fact, they represent the biggest problem that humans have ever had. The failure of the energy system at this point, above all, is the failure of the climate system. And so the fact that we've melted the Arctic in the last 30 years, or the fact that the world's oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago, are pretty systemic signs of large-scale failure of that system. We also see the paradigms emerging of what the next architectures for human civilization look like, I think. And the clearest of those is the emerging architecture of the internet. For those of you much younger than me, which is almost everyone, it's hard to recall, but when I was growing up, the information system looked very much like the energy system does now. There were a few giant providers, ABC, NBC, CBS, you know, maybe three, and it all worked one way. We sat in our living rooms and absorbed what they sent us from some centralized location. Not very different from our electric system, say, at the moment. But the rapid advent and spread of the internet, the most interesting technological development of our lifetimes by far, I think, turned that upside down in a minute. And now we are all both providers and consumers of information in a kind of unprecedented and very interesting way, not without its problems, but in many ways quite liberating and engaging. One can imagine an energy system that works much the same way that the internet now works, where instead of a few centralized providers, we have 100 million solar panels on 100 million roofs, all interconnected through a grid, all of us both producers and consumers of energy. And one can imagine the kind of implications that begin to flow from a world like that. Let's lay aside for a moment all the kind of interesting technical questions about storage capacity of batteries and how grids work and so on and so forth. Let's assume that human beings will continue with their ability to kind of develop these sort of things. What would that world look and feel like? How would it be different than the world that we inhabit at the moment? The biggest change would be a change in scale. By its very nature, renewable energy is sort of the opposite of fossil energy. Instead of being concentrated in a few places, it's widely dispersed. It's omnipresent, but it's diffuse. And to collect it effectively, in some places like the Texas Plains, you can get a fair amount of wind, or the Mojave Desert, you can get a fair amount of sun. But in fact, you also can get some of this everywhere. And that's how these systems can develop. If you look, say, at the country of Germany, which has done more than any other to pursue, far more than any other, to pursue this paradigm, there were days last summer when the Germans generated more than half the power they used from solar panels within their borders, which, when you look at the latitude of Germany on a map, should put all of us completely to shame. If the Germans can do that, why on earth is Texas generating any of its power with anything other than the sun and the wind? You know, that dispersed power is inherently less prone to disruption, you know, of all kinds. Technical disruption, societal disruption, that is, I have solar panels all over my roof. A terrorist could decide, I guess, that he wanted to do something about those, and he could put a ladder up against the wall and, you know, climb on the roof with a hammer and break my solar panels, which would piss me off mightily. But it wouldn't send deadly solar particles, you know, out across the atmosphere, and it wouldn't crash the entire electric grid, and it wouldn't do all those things. It's also less prone to the kind of, because it's smaller in scale, that world is less prone to the kind of disruption by particular powerful corporations or individuals. Last week, it was disclosed that the two Koch brothers, the great oil and gas barons of our society, their net worth combined passed $100 billion. Okay? They dwarf Bill Koch or Warren Buffett or anybody else. And they've, of course, used that money to dramatically affect the political landscape, they and many of the other players in this world. 2 weeks before the last election, Chevron gave the largest single corporate campaign donation in history that was designed to make sure that the House of Representatives stayed in the hands of climate deniers, and it was successful. That kind of scale is not possible, or much less likely, in a world where that economic balance has begun to shift towards the smaller and more local. Smaller and more localized come with other benefits too. One of the stories that we've told ourselves is that we live in the best of all possible worlds, and nothing could make us happier than to live in the world that we're living in. It's possible that Texans have been particularly good at telling themselves this story over the years and had a great deal about it. What's interesting is to look at the data. Every year since the end of World War II, one of the big polling firms has asked Americans the same question. They've said, are you happy with your life? And the number of Americans, the percentage who answer that they're very happy with their lives, peaks in 1956 and goes steadily downhill since then. Roughly a quarter of Americans will make that claim at the moment, even though in that intervening half century, our standard of living has trebled by the ways that we usually measure it. That is to say, we have appliances now to do jobs we didn't even imagine needed doing 50 years ago. We can go to the store and find foods that we didn't even know existed. We can, in a matter of seconds, download any even theoretically musical sound emitted almost anywhere on the planet, you know. We can do all kinds of things, and you would think that we would be extremely happy. But that's not actually in the lived experience. And as people have started to think about why, and I wrote a book some years ago that was partly about this, as people have begun to think about why, the economists have been really at the forefront of this, behavioral economists. One of the things that they notice, and if you think about it, the kind of time frame makes a lot of sense, one of the things that they've noticed is that it's possible that past a certain point, it's not just that there isn't a correlation between more affluence and less happiness, it's that there's a causation that begins to happen. What was the thing in the mid-1950s that really shifted in America? What happened in the mid-1950s and really ever since was that we embarked on the project at which we've excelled of building bigger houses farther apart from each other. Okay? That's been what most of our wealth has been spent on in the post-war decades. And the American dream became synonymous with as large a house as possible, really as far away from anybody else as possible. The drawbacks to that in energy terms are obvious. I mean, that's why we use as much energy as we do. It takes a lot of energy to heat and cool your own, you know, small fortress, and if you have to drive everywhere you are back and forth, that takes a lot of energy too. But what wasn't so obvious was that it would take its toll on our perceptions of the world. If you're living in that kind of space, then your chances of running into other people in the course of the day are dramatically reduced. It's just geometry or sort of Brownian motion or something. The odds of seeing other people go down. In fact, the average American has half as many close friends as the average American 50 years ago. If you'd been sitting in this room 50 years ago, statistically, you would have had twice as many people with whom you were really close. Okay? That's a very large change for a socially evolved primate to encounter. And it probably does a lot to explain why that world hasn't sort of transported us into, you know, sort of realms of ecstasy, even as we've gotten much richer. So, the question becomes, what happens when you begin to break down those scales, you break down those walls? What happens when you begin to build systems, whether they're energy systems or information systems or food systems, that actually have you interacting with your neighbors again? If you think about it, neighbors have been an optional thing for Americans for the last 50 years. For the very first time in human history, it really hasn't mattered for your survival whether or not you knew your neighbors. I think that that's changing for physical reasons. It's going to be a much more difficult century because of climate change. But I think it's also starting to change because we're imagining different ways of being. Think about food systems. The most interesting thing that's happened in our food system over the last 15 or 20 years is that it's begun to mirror what's going on in our information system. There's been an explosion in local food production. The fastest growing parts of our food economy have been farmers' markets. The number of farms in America for the first time in 150 years has gone up instead of down because there's a lot more small farming going on. We just had an excellent breakfast here in the School of Architecture, and the people who made it were able to name every farm that every ingredient had come from, you know, and it was a very good sign. But here's what's interesting about it. Not just that you use less energy if you farm that way, that's trivial in a sense. It's that you keep building this other kind of world. A pair of sociologists a couple of years ago followed shoppers, first around a supermarket, then around the farmer's market. You all have been to the supermarkets, you know how that works. You walk in, you fall into a light fluorescent trance, you visit the stations of the cross around the supermarket. Maybe you have the very interesting credit versus debit discussion at the end. That's it. When they followed shoppers around farmer's markets, they found that they were having 10 times as many conversations per visit. Not 10% more, 10 times more, an order of magnitude more. That's largely, I think, what the attraction was, along with the good food. People were beginning to re-knit back some of that lost civic texture that supplied a great deal of the pleasure in human lives. And it comes in many other forms, too, once we start down those paths. For instance, we've, you know, if we have a great environmental sin above all in this country, It's that we've exalted the private automobile, or in Texas, the private pickup truck, into the, you know, sort of center of one's being. And yet it comes with a great cost too, not just the energy cost, not just the financial cost of maintaining it all, not all of that, but also the human cost of not being, the opportunity cost of not being in contact with other people in the course of getting oneself around. That's why it's a great, almost everybody who goes to Western Europe and spends a few days on the train system there is left thinking, why can't we have this too? What genetic thing about Belgians has allowed them to be so good of trains, you know? In fact, nothing. We built great train networks in this country long ago, and there was a time when every small town in Texas had a train depot that's now been converted to a, you know, bank or something, but where trains came and went and people were able to get around. And that day could come back and probably needs to come back if we're going to deal with our energy problems. I think that the world, in other words, on the other side of fossil fuel is quite interesting, different, because it matters where the power that powers one's life comes from. And if it comes in different forms, it produces different outcomes, different ways of being. And I think that that means we could really imagine getting to that world. It needn't be particularly scary. In fact, you can tell that people, I think, are already attracted in that direction. One of the most interesting pieces of data, hopeful from my point of view, about from the last 10 years, is that the number of young people in this country who are interested in owning their own car has plummeted. The age at which people get their driver's license has gone way, way up by 3 or 4 years. The percentage of people who want to own a car, as I say, is much, much smaller. Many, many young Americans now want to move. I mean, the single most favored destination for young Americans at the moment in this country is Brooklyn, New York, where people are crowding in because it's an incredibly pleasurable place to live, in close contact with other human beings, easily navigable by bike or by bus or by subway, a very different vision than the one we've had for the last 50 years. So, the question is, for me, can we move in this direction fast enough to keep that, to my mind, quite pleasant vision of a new future from being overwhelmed by the destruction that we've caused by following this older paradigm? That is, can we do this fast enough to get ahead of the curve of destruction from climate change? And that, I think, is a very open question, and there are times when I'm prone to pessimism about it, okay? But that's what I want to talk about for just a minute, because that involves, it involves politics, and it involves change if we're going to make it, and that's basically though I like writing about and thinking about and researching all this other stuff, I now seem to spend all my time instead trying to get the political change necessary to move us in that direction fast. The problem with systems is that they're sticky, that there's a lot of inertia in systems that keeps us using them past the time when they're optimal for us to be using them, okay? And there are particular features of our energy system that make it particularly sticky, the biggest feature of which is the amount of money that it has generated for the very small number of people who run it. The fossil fuel industry is the richest industry in the history of human enterprise. Your native corporation, ExxonMobil, made more money last year than any company in the history of money, okay? And that money in our political system enables you to buy inordinate political influence and keep the status quo from changing at the pace at which it needs to change. We got a remarkable example of this from ExxonMobil last week. Shareholders had demanded that Exxon explain how it was going to deal with the emerging understanding that they have in their reserves, they and other fossil fuel companies, about five times as much carbon as the scientists tell us would be necessary to take us past the 2-degree global warming mark that scientists have set for as the kind of bottom line for catastrophe. That is to say, if you add up all the coal and gas and oil they've already identified and announced that they intend to burn to shareholders and things, it's five times as much as science says we can burn. That is, if their business plan is followed, the planet tanks. Okay? So shareholders, some shareholders said, explain to us how you're going to deal with this. What is your plan for dealing with these, what in a sensible world would be stranded assets? Okay? How is that going to affect your valuation? Exxon, in their statement, said, we don't think that those will ever become stranded assets. We plan on burning all of them because we don't think any government will, we think it's highly unlikely, quote unquote, that any government will prevent us from doing it. What they didn't say, but what went unspoken, was it's highly unlikely because we have the political power to stop them from ever restricting us. That's the fight that we're now engaged in. If we're going to have a kind of interesting future, we have to figure out how to get off, how to overcome that political power with political power of our own. We're not going to outspend Exxon in that fight. That's not one of the possibilities. Okay? So the possibilities come down to finding other currencies in which to work. And the only currencies we've been able to think of are the sort of currencies of movements. Passion, spirit, creativity, sometimes the willingness to spend our bodies, you know. I went to jail with a bunch of other people in what turned out to be the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years about anything in this country a couple of years ago in Washington, D.C., when we were trying to stop, so far successfully, the construction of this Keystone Pipeline down out of the tar sands of Canada. And we can talk all about the math and science of that if we want. But for the moment, suffice it just to say that it was necessary to do that in order to make it a public issue. Otherwise, it simply would have been built as these things always get built. If I push some of these buttons, am I going to see the slide for my presentation here? Yes, there we go. I showed some of these last night. Now, these are just... We've organized about 20,000 demonstrations around the world over the last 5 years. CNN called it the most widespread displays of political activity in the planet's history. And this is just to give you a sense of how this kind of resistance to fossil fuels is beginning to grow in every corner of the planet. And it's been very beautiful to do and a great deal of fun, and you can see the kind of people that, some of these in places I'd never even heard of, you know. But all over the world, people getting engaged in this fight in big ways. And that's very powerful and very sweet. We've used art. We made these days of art projects with so many people, images so big we had to photograph them from outer space, you know. Those are your neighbors in Santa Fe and a dried-up riverbed, and when the satellite came over, 3,000 people put blue blankets overhead to kind of bring the screen back to life for a minute, you know. Beautiful images. But we also have had to accelerate the pace of all this because we have a very short window in which to work, and hence things like this fight against the Keystone Pipeline, which had been... you know, who knows how it's all going to come out, but as I say, you know, they expected 3 years ago to have this thing built, and for the moment all they've got is a huge pile of rusting pipe in vacant lots across the heartland. These are our, you know, these are what's on the line. This is, you know, a couple of years ago, a year ago, we asked our people around the world to rally in places that had already felt the sting of climate change, okay? And even though we're used to working on a large scale, we were surprised by the response. There were about 3,000 demonstrations all over the place, not just the fewest, you know, just visions of what, you know, sea level rise. Some of the problems in some places are a little less severe, but all of it, forest fire across Siberia, and, you know, people leaving their homes in low-lying Pacific islands now. Top Red Balloon is where the level of Dead Sea was 40 years ago. Just astonishing pictures. These from the belt in Pakistan, where in 2010 the greatest flood probably since Noah covered a quarter of the country with the Indus River and forced 20 million people from their homes. Okay. That's my home state of Vermont, where we're still recovering from hurricane. If you can see the sanded in fields in the background there, but just all over the place. And the fight is very real. This is probably the smallest demonstration of the day. It's just a street in Haiti that's turned into a kind of muddy river. And the reason the picture caught my mind was, my eye was just with those signs that the kids were holding. Your actions affect me, which is true. More people died in Haiti from Hurricane Sandy than in New York. There's still a cholera outbreak underway, kind of in its wake. Okay? Your actions affect me, but not the other way around. There's nothing anybody in Haiti can do to slow down climate change or to speed this transition. It's only those of us who have access to levers of power in places like Texas or Washington that really matter, that can do much about it. That's why we've launched this campaign around the world calling for divestment from the fossil fuel industry. And already many colleges and many churches and many city governments, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, Providence, others around the world, have announced that they're selling their stock in fossil fuel companies, not because they think they can bankrupt Exxon, but because they think they can politically bankrupt them and begin to take away enough of their legitimacy that it becomes harder for them to do politically the things that they've been doing. What I'm trying to say here is, and I'll stop so we can talk, what I'm trying to say is we're at one of those moments when it's possible that a new world that kind of works could emerge, but it won't emerge if we don't make it emerge pretty quickly, because the weight of what we're doing with climate change is so great that it will overwhelm that emergence. We've raised the temperature 1 degree so far, and that's been enough to melt the Arctic. The same scientists who told us that would happen now tell us we are on course for 4 or 5 degree centigrade increase in global temperature before the century is out. And if that happens, then all we're going to do in this world is kind of endless emergency response to things. That's what our world will look like, okay? And we won't be able to kind of build what comes next at the rate and pace that we should. That's why these things seem so important to me. I'm not by nature a political activist of any kind. In fact, I don't like it. I'm a writer, and I'd much rather be at home writing, you know. But I think that this political fight has become the kind of central fight in figuring out whether we've got an opportunity to continue developing and prospering as civilizations, or whether we're going to be fighting a kind of defensive rearguard action against Mother Nature for a very long time to come. That's why I'm out on the road all the time. That's why I'm really glad to see this movement emerging. That's why I was glad. I mean, every day things happen that make it me hopeful that we can get where we need to go. Yesterday, the faculty at Harvard voted to demand that Harvard divest its shares in fossil fuels. That's a good sign. Harvard's an important place. So is Texas A&M. in a different, you know, in a different vein, because you guys are closer to the centers of power in the fossil fuel industry. It's clear that in the short term, you know, A&M's not going to divest its fossil fuel stock, but it's also clear that a campaign to at least work in that direction here would be a powerful, useful thing, help illuminate the stakes for people all around. Yesterday afternoon, Desmond Tutu, the great hero of the fight against apartheid, reminded us that, wrote a great piece reminding us that divestment had been one of the key tools in the fight against apartheid, one of the two or three things that tipped the balance against the racist government of South Africa, and he called for exactly the same tactic to be used with the fossil fuel industry now. These moments don't happen all that often, but when they do happen, they're important. And for our generation, you know, for our for earlier generations, the key things were the fight against fascism in Europe, and you know, a lot of people had to go die, or the fight against segregation in the American South, and a lot of people had to be very courageous and put themselves on the line. In our time, the great fight, and one whose implications, what happens over the next 10 years will matter for 10,000 years, our fight is whether we can make this transition quickly enough away from fossil fuel and onto something else. And that's why I do what I do, and I'm really grateful to those of you who are helping along the same line. So thank you all very much. And now if we use it, can we just talk back and forth? Is that, yeah. You're in charge here.
Yeah, here we go. I obviously can't talk very loud, so I need the microphone. what I was saying is that if you can yell your question out so everybody can hear, that's fine. Let me just recognize you before you stand up, or I can bring the microphone to you. Sure. Go ahead. Yeah, stand up, please.
Earlier on in your conversation, you mentioned that in order for the world that you envision of environmental energy policy, that corporate influence needs to be much smaller, much more individual. But that brings that for me, that reminds me of the work that becomes really Simons, who wrote pretty heavily on environmental policy, more in terms of population change, but I feel like it's pretty well. Point that he made in terms of policy that for him, the market is what was going to drive this innovation, these key changes that we would
sure.
see in policy. How do you feel in your own personal research that the market will play?
So I think markets actually could play a very important role in this transition. The problem with climate change is that markets are entirely ignorant of the problem. We haven't done the one thing that government most needs to do, which is feed into markets one piece of information, that carbon carries a serious price. Okay? At the moment, corporations, you know, alone among corporations, industries, anybody else, fossil fuel industry is allowed to just treat this as an externality and pay no attention about it. So, I mean, think about it. A restaurant here in College Station at the end of the day has a pile of trash sitting around, right? The cheapest remedy for getting rid of the pile of trash would be to just carry it out into the middle of the street and dump it there, okay? To externalize the cost of this trash. But we've decided that's a bad idea because pretty soon you have rats and, you know, so on. It comes at a, so they're obliged to pay someone to come take it away. Okay? The only people who aren't are the fossil fuel industry, and they're allowed to pour what's now the most dangerous thing we've got, carbon dioxide, in unlimited quantities into the atmosphere. They get to use it as an open sewer for free. So every economist that I know, left, right, and center, has long ago concluded that one of the things we need to do to deal with climate change is to put a price on that carbon. It can only happen if governments do it, okay? There's no other mechanism for making it happen. How do you do that? Probably the best scheme is what people now are calling fee and dividend. You put a serious price on carbon. Maybe you put it a high enough price on that we run the cost of a gallon of gasoline up to what it's been in Europe for 50 years, you know, $8 a gallon. That's why Europeans have nice cities and good train systems and all those kind of things. But you take the money that you collect from that hefty tax and you just write a check to everybody in the country every month for their share of it, all right? The argument being that if anybody owns the sky, it's us, not Exxon. 80% of Americans would come out ahead in that scheme. You wouldn't come out ahead if you own a Learjet, you know, but you shouldn't come out ahead if you own a Learjet. At this point, that's a deeply antisocial activity for which you should pay a price. If we do that, it will clearly speed us in the direction of that renewable transition at a rapid rate. So the reason we don't do that, the reason we've avoided the advice of every economist that has written about all this, is precisely because it would cut into the record profits of the fossil fuel industry. And they have had the political power to make sure that it doesn't happen. The few places where it has happened, it's worked pretty well. British Columbia is the biggest example. They've had it for 4 or 5 years, a scheme like that. It's cut emissions pretty dramatically. And in the most recent polling, 65% of people said they liked this tax in BC, which it's very rare to find 65% of people liking any tax of any kind, you know? So I think that there are, and if you think about it, these are very conservative mechanisms to accomplish these kinds of ends, you know? These are the only levers probably big enough to pull at this point that'll make a big difference, are the levers of markets and things. And that's it for your question, such a good one.
I'm trying to record it. We want to get your voice. We want to get your voice on there.
All right.
Howdy. All right. Fantastic. Howdy. From your presentation, it sounds like it's a cultural fight, correct, or of some sort.
Well, yeah, it has cultural components, but at some level, it's a fight like any other fight over power.
Okay.
And who gets to hold it and who gets to profit from it.
Okay. And one of the examples you used was segregation in the American South,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
In that fight, there were leaders, Martin Luther King Jr., mm-hmm. Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Yep.
Is there a system in place or a way to identify the Malcolm X's, the Marcus Garvey's, et cetera, of this cultural fight?
That's a very good question, and one I've thought about and written about some over the years. I think we're in a slightly different moment. I think that we're not going to have great leaders on the scale of Dr. King. The one kind of exception that proved the rule away in this fight was when it looked like Al Gore was sort of, you know, won the Nobel Prize and all of that. But because in part he was such an identifiable leader, he became a kind of lightning rod and got taken down in a lot of ways, you know, in sort of tragic ways, and is less effective now than he would have been. I think that that's okay. One of the things that's changed with the world is with the rise of the internet, that we're able to have a movement that operates a little differently, where we have all kinds of leaders all over the place, some of them local, some of them temporary, some of the people arrive, and we're able to coordinate action, ideas, and things and pass them around much more easily and to work in coalition much more easily. And so the kind of huge heroic figures like Dr. King, it'd be nice if we had them, but since we don't, in a way, I think we're sort of working around it fairly well. And so to my mind, the analogy is to like the resistance during, say, World War II with the French or something. And there were, nobody knew who the leaders were, nobody knew who the kind of members were, but they were coordinated enough in this kind of underground way
it's good to be spread out and sprawling like that, because the fossil fuel industry is spread out and sprawling. You saw those pictures from every corner of the world, you know. We're causing trouble for these guys every place we can think of it. You know, so the Keystone Pipeline in the center of the country, the coal ports they want to build on the Pacific Northwest, the LNG export facilities they want to build on the East Coast. Our crew in Australia is just, you know, in jail now for doing this big civil disobedience outside a vast planned new coal mine. You know, same thing going on someplace around the world every day now. And that's good. That kind of architecture, it's kind of like the architecture, it's kind of a movement that, like the energy architecture that I was proposing. Instead of a few great leaders, instead of a few centralized power plants, we have a spread out group of people kind of leading, working together, just like we have a spread out grid of millions of solar panels. If Dr. King arises, you know, we won't say no, you know, if someone appears. But it's good that it doesn't. It's good that it doesn't depend on that. That's a very good question. Yes.
Thank you. You mentioned solar panels several times.
Yeah.
My question is mainly about the issue of embodied energy and your thoughts about that.
Sure. I mean, it takes power to make these things. We think now that, you know, given reasonable, you know, given a place to put them like Texas with plenty of sun, you get the energy payback in a couple of years, and then the thing lasts for 25, you know. So it's not perfect, nothing is. It's a lot better than what we've got at the moment. But there's always an energy cost, and we should be using the energy we've got at the moment to be building the energy we need in the future, I think, is sort of one way of thinking about it. It's a good question.
Along the same lines with that, what about the material costs, like the poisonous materials in a lot of solar panels, like selenium, gallium, arsenide? How do you compare that to the energy cost?
Well, one of the problems with climate change is that it's so vast and pervasive and overarching that we end up triaging a ton of other troubles, okay? So there are serious pollution costs that come with solar panels. There are some land use costs that come with windmills. There are, you know, in an ideal world, we'd have some power source that didn't do any of these things. But given the options, given the fact that it's very clear that continuing to depend on coal and gas and oil breaks the planet in half and in a very short order, then we've got to do our best to make solar panels in cleaner fashion, and we're starting to do that kind of thing. But they are a great hope, not a great curse, I think.
Speaking of vast problems, as a child of the 70s, it seems like we were talking a lot more about population issues than we are now, when to me it's the underlying issue behind all of this with power. Could you speak to that?
Sure. I actually wrote a book about population some years ago called Maybe One, An Argument for Smaller Families. And I have one wonderful child myself. But population, there are two things to be said. One, it's the thing we've done the best on, okay? The indicator that that's gone in the best possible direction. 35 years ago, the average woman on this planet had 6 children. That number is now 2.4 and continuing to fall. So an astonishing change in a very short period of time. How did it happen? It happened because people, especially in the developing world, figured out what the best possible contraceptive was. It was female education and empowerment to any degree. And it turns out that given that option, almost, you know, given any kind of power over their lives, very few people want to have 6 children. Okay? So it shifted very quickly. from this point on, most of the, I mean, the population is about 7 billion now, and it'll grow to 9 billion in the course of this century before it plateaus on those curves, okay? 9 billion is not going to be easier to handle than 7 billion, but almost all that population growth is coming in places where people use so little energy that it makes almost no difference. We forget how big the gulfs are. The average American family uses more energy between the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve and dinner on January 2nd than the average African family uses in a year, okay? So the number of Tanzanians in climate change terms is a rounding error. It doesn't matter. There are plenty of other problems that you cause for yourselves by too rapid population growth, but yeah. The problem we face is this ever-accelerating consumption curve and figuring out how to bend that the way we did fertility. I mean, in essence, the reason that we're running into this carbon crisis is because places with relatively stable populations, like China, are now starting to consume like Americans. Okay? It turns out that the planet probably can't support one continent, ours, consuming that way, but it definitely can't support three or four continents consuming in that fashion. Okay? So we have to figure out what breaks that consumption curve, and the hope is that a price on carbon would go a long ways towards getting us there, and that it would head us. And that's what's encouraging to me about some of these things I was describing. You know, if you go to Brooklyn and spend your life there as opposed to the suburbs of Dallas or something, well, then you're consuming an enormous amount less in the course of your life, and it's possible, at least a lot of people are finding, that you're having a happier life doing it, you know, along the way. It's a fascinating moment in those ways. Do we have time for one more? I don't want to keep people past there.
Thank you for being here today. Yeah. It's easy to become overwhelmed with the complexity of this issue, so I'm just curious from your perspective, you know, if you have a list of people, as an individual, what would be your top few things you thought people could do to actually make an impact and feel like you're doing
sure.
something?
I think that I think that's the right question. I'd say don't spend an enormous amount of time worrying about your sort of personal habits. It's important to put solar panels on the roof and ride a bike and all that. You know, those are all things I've done and believe in, but I don't try not to fool myself for a minute into thinking that they amount to actual change. Our problem is structural and systemic. It'll be changed structurally and systemically or not at all. And that means engaging in politics. That means organizing. Okay? So far more important than, you know, getting all the, I mean, if I were on campus someplace, it's nice to get, you know, better light bulbs in all the buildings or have recycling or something. It's way more important to get the college divested from fossil fuel, because that has some chance of changing the basic political equation that's our problem. That's the sort of change that I've come to think of over the, I mean, very different than I would have answered that question 10 or 15 years ago, because I just appreciate more and more all the time where the problem actually lies. And how much time one can spend being diverted from getting to that. On the we all only have so much time. Organizing is a good way to spend it if you're eager to get real change happening. Upstairs.
Thanks. I noticed that you had, of course, you mentioned that you received the Thomas Merton Prize and, of course, the Gandhi Prize, and I'm a great admirer of Thomas Merton. I'm curious also, in your Wikipedia page, it talks about your influences, in the Gospel of Matthew, Book of Job. I know in these kind of settings, it's not popular to talk about sort of spiritual backgrounds and things like that, yet it's a driver in many people's lives, many of our lives. And I was just curious if you could speak a little bit about those influences and
sure.
and why specifically those ones.
Sure. Well, I'm a Methodist and a Sunday school teacher and things. Part of the for Christians, these are particularly acute problems. We were told on the very first page of the good book that the first thing God asked us to do was to take care of this planet. To exercise dominion over it, which does not mean wreck it. And we're doing a poor job with that. It's like as if you ask someone to babysit for your kid and you came home and your kid had like tattoos and piercings and all that. You're like, oh, that's not what I had in mind. That's basically where we are. And for those of us who take the gospel seriously, the idea that we're supposed to love our neighbors is sort of made a mockery of by the fact that with the ways we live, we're drowning our neighbors and making it impossible for them to grow their food and so on and so forth. And that's why Desmond Tutu, probably the greatest churchman in the world today, that's why it meant so much to me yesterday when he demanded this fossil fuel divestment. He pointed out that the whole continent of Africa uses about 1% of the world's fossil fuel. There's nothing they can do to affect the outcome of this story except ask us as brothers and sisters to do what at some level we all know we should be doing anyway. So I take it as a good sign that the religious communities are really beginning to wake up here. One of the first groups to demand divestment was the United Church of Christ, which is really the oldest Protestant denomination in this country, the direct descendants of the pilgrims who arrived in Massachusetts. Those are all good signs. And I think we'll see more and more of that in the time ahead, because the contradictions between the way we're wrecking the world that we were asked to defend, steward, are just too great. And if you don't, just at a certain point, your head just explodes if you don't sort of try and match up those things somehow. So there I will end. Thank you all very much.